policy analyst in his late 40s who lives in New York City, divorced his wife 6 years ago and says that he never anticipated that living alone would be so compelling. He has a flexible work schedule, and on most evenings he stays up late exercising at the gym, watching sports and movies, or socializing in restaurants and bars. He dates often and remarks on how easy it is for a successful man his age to find smart, attractive, and available women in the city. It's a single man's luxury, he acknowledges, but it's not one he enjoyed when he was young. Stephen got married in his early 20s before he had much experience with other women and became a father soon after. He adores his children, but he grew estranged from his wife as their interests veered in different directions. His career took off and the world opened up to him just as his home life began to be constraining. Stephen spent years pouring himself into work, partly because he liked it and partly, he now believes, to avoid confronting his family situation. Eventually, the problems grew impossible to ignore. Counseling didn't help much because he and his wife were fundamentally incompatible. The marriage could be justified only for the sake of their children, and who could say that they were better off living in an unhappy home? 2 years after the separation, Stephen got involved with a younger woman who wanted something serious, and he was drawn to the idea. She might not have been a perfect match for him, but she seemed pretty close. They had a great sex life, liked each other's friends, traveled well together, and shared taste in movies as well as work interests. They started spending several nights a week in each other's apartment, and eventually, like so many other couples living in expensive cities, they found it hard to justify the costs. She moved into his place, and Stephen enjoyed sharing a home with her. Until he didn't. The problem, he realized, was that living with someone, even a woman he loved, meant denying himself the chance to enjoy an unfettered existence, dating new women, staying out as long as he wanted and not worrying about anyone else, watching sports, seeing movies, meeting friends. Stephen had grown to appreciate the virtues of living lightly, without obligations. He was willing to give up some of this, but after his girlfriend had moved in, the relationship took on more weight than he could handle. When she started bringing up marriage, perhaps even children, everything snapped. "I feel awful about it because I really do love her," Stephen tells me. "But there's something in me that just cannot commit to another relationship. And part of it is that I really like living alone right now. There's just too much to give up." Charlotte, who was mulling over a marriage proposal during our first interview, has also decided that she'd lose too much if she accepted. In our follow-up interview, she explains that, after 14 years of going solo, she's not willing to give up her independent lifestyle. She has grown anxious about intimacy, and particularly about letting someone see how she acts and who she is when she's in her own space. As she enumerates some of her domestic quirks, eating what she wants when she wants to, spending full days in her pajamas, keeping the TV and radio on at the same time, she says that her suitor doesn't have a clue who I am and predicts that it would slide downhill once he found out. Right now, Charlotte says, things are simply too good to risk giving up everything for a live-in companion who may not love her when he really gets to know her. She is hardly certain that she has made the right decision. "You'll have to interview me again in 20 years, she jokes. And if things turn out badly, she promises to complain, "Why didn't you stop me then when I had a chance?" Charlotte has a good sense of humor about her predicament, but divorcees who live alone in their 50s and early 60s often have a hard time confronting their concerns about growing older on their own. Some get previews of how challenging it might be during episodes of severe illness or injury. Sam, who once struggled with alcoholism, suffered a heart attack, had major surgery, and then developed a severe lung infection about a year ago. "I didn't know if I was going to live or not," he recalls. "I stayed in the hospital from August to November, and I don't even remember August and September." What was certain, however, was that he would be unable to take care of himself after the hospital released him, and that meant calling on family members to help. His mother, who's in her late 80s, had visited him after the operation, but she was unfit for the responsibility of managing his care at home. Fortunately, Sam has always been close to his sister in Washington, and she offered to look after him if he could move in with her. Though it was far from California, his boss was willing to give him extra time to recover, and Sam spent 2 months recuperating in his sister's house before he was well enough to return. Now he says, "Everybody thinks I need to get married and have a wife to take care of him." But Sam took away a different lesson. His family would be there for him when he needed them most. Not everyone shares this confidence. Lou, the 57-year-old attorney and musician in Berkeley, has a back condition that occasionally leaves him hurting like hell and hardly able to walk. When he lived in San Francisco, he could call on his son to help him move around his apartment or get food and medicine. Now his son has moved elsewhere, and he doesn't have any family nearby. So what would he do if he were bedridden, or worse? Maybe somebody could. He takes a long pause and thinks about it. I could call somebody. I don't know. The issue gnaws at him during the interview, and by the end he is adamant that he needs to find a partner before he gets much older. I'd really like to have some companionship, he acknowledges. Is it too much to ask? The divorced women we interviewed had more faith in their support system of friends and family, in part because they had worked so hard to build and sustain it. This isn't surprising since, as psychologists such as Carol Gilligan have argued, from an early age girls are encouraged to develop intimate relationships and to value mutual support, while boys are pushed into larger group settings such as sports teams where competitive, rule-based activities prevail. According to one review of the literature on gender and social networks, from childhood to adolescence, girls appear to seek more help and support from others than do boys. The result is that, compared to men, adult women tend to be more empathic and sensitive to the needs of others. They also tend to be more active social planners, which helps them stay connected even after their marriages fall apart. As for Madeline, she would be thrilled to find the right romantic partner to accompany her on the next part of her life. But she would also be shocked, since every story she knows or statistic she hears suggests that it's not going to happen. Most of her closest friends are single women who live alone too, and they all expect to stay that way. By any objective measure, we should be depressed as hell, Madeline says. What's surprising is that I'm not, and none of the women I know are. It's almost one of the best times of my life. I have more friends now than I've ever had, and I'm making a concerted effort to enlarge my social circle. Madeline reads a lot of science, and she has come to believe that expanding her social network could help protect her from the dangers of growing isolated as she ages. She's been reaching out to new people in hope of enriching her life with the kinds of social capital that the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam made famous. She's determined not to be alone. Madeline sees her behavior as more than simply strategic, however, because she enjoys the experience of putting herself out there and seeing what happens. She's over 60 after all, and if she doesn't try things now, when will she? In recent years, Madeline has started using social networking sites quite often. A site like Meetup.com helps her find discussion partners who speak Italian or share her interest in politics, and she finds an occasional date on Craigslist. She connected with her neighbor a few years ago, and now the two of them often knock on each other's door and take spontaneous walks to local cafes and parks. She also decided to get to know some of the gay men in her neighborhood whose social world had always seemed closed to her. Now she says, I am the fag hag of the Western world, if you'll excuse that expression. I can go out every night with another young gay man, and they are wonderful to me. Wonderful company. She hasn't yet had to activate her support system for anything more than the occasional emotional boost that everyone needs. But she trusts that her friends will be there for her when she needs them. And after one failed marriage and then a 12-year relationship that dissolved, she can't say that about a romantic partner. Now, Madeline insists, she's not going to do anything to jeopardize the strength of her network. There's such a thing as too much togetherness. If I were to find a relationship, we wouldn't have to do everything together. We wouldn't have to share friends. And I never again want anybody living with me, nor do I ever want to live with someone else. 4. Protecting the self. No one really bowls alone. The provocative phrase from Robert Putnam's sweeping account of the decline of civic participation in the United States is a metaphor, not a finding, as he acknowledged. Putnam used it with great effect to dramatize the fact that participation in bowling leagues had fallen during the second half of the 20th century, as had participation in a number of historically significant civic associations and membership groups, from the Boy Scouts to the Elks Clubs and the League of Women Voters. The truth is, Americans continue bowling together, but with friends and friends of friends in their social network, not in formal teams or organized groups. The distinction is important. When Bowling Alone was published in 2000, pundits and policymakers worried that families were watching TV together in their living rooms rather than interacting with each other in the public sphere. Today, our most pressing social concerns are different, and not just because we're nostalgic about the days when family members watched TV together rather than on their own mini-screens. In the first years of the 21st century, we've witnessed the rise of new forms of interpersonal engagement and civic participation, from Move On to MySpace, e-government programs to micro-lending initiatives such as Kiva. We are, as headlines tell us, addicted to social media, trapped in a world wide web, caught in the net. Our most burning questions about the nature of contemporary society are not about isolation, but the problem of being hyper-connected, or of living with what the technology guru Linda Stone calls continuous partial attention, because we are so deeply embedded in the personal, professional, and social activities we perform online. All of this should affect the way we understand how and why we live alone today. Whether or not we go solo, most of us are immersed in one or more social worlds, and today a growing number of critics have begun to worry that we are in too deep. We are experiencing the end of solitude, writes the essayist William Derezowitz, who claims that in contemporary culture, we live exclusively in relation to others, and that too many of us find it impossible to be alone. The sociologist Dalton Conley goes further, arguing that we are witnessing the death of the individual and the birth of intravisuals, busy professionals whose lives are dedicated to managing the myriad data streams, impulses, desires, and even consciousness that we experience in our heads as we navigate multiple worlds. Arguments like these are intriguing, but not quite persuasive. Granted, there is good reason to worry about the cognitive development of young people who spend their days steeping in text messages, TV, and the Internet, about the rise of knowledge-based service sector jobs that require professionals to spend their days and nights emailing and doing relationship management with clients or colleagues, about the psychological well-being of crackberry junkies who cannot focus on the world beyond their smartphone. But does this really signal the end of solitude or individualism? After all, the network society emerged only after massive numbers of young adults began living alone for the first time in history, and unprecedented numbers of children started growing up in rooms of their own. It's hard not to see a relationship between the demand for constant connection, whether online or on the job, and the enormous increase in the amount of time we spend on our own. And it's important to note that not everyone, indeed most of us, aren't always elsewhere, seeking out contact or a new Facebook friend. In fact, we interviewed a number of people who said living alone was a way to buffer themselves against the intense pressures of social and especially vocational life. To be sure, this strategy for protecting the self means something different for affluent and middle-class people than it does for the poor, the mentally ill, or the physically frail. For successful professionals, living alone as a form of self-protection typically means establishing one's home as a sanctuary in the city, one that facilitates the very pursuit of solitude and self-discovery that Derezowitz and Conley fear we've abandoned. It doesn't always work this way, however. Some of the affluent and middle-class people we interviewed acknowledged that they'd sought out a place of their own to avoid toxic relationships or to escape from a community that took more than it gave. The disadvantaged men we interviewed were even more likely to report motivations like this. For them, living alone can easily lead to a dangerous extreme, resulting not only in domestic autonomy, but also in reclusiveness, hoarding, and other antisocial behaviors that turn one's safe house into a tomb. Even more judicious forms of social withdrawal may lead to a kind of miserable security, as in the case of many of the ex-convicts, substance abusers, and unemployed men who take refuge in single-room occupancy hotels, SROs, and cheap efficiency apartments to avoid friends and family whose company brings more trouble than it's worth. Living alone is a way to protect the self, yet it also risks imperiling it. And it's no surprise that people in good physical, emotional, and financial health are better able to find the right balance than those who are sick or poor. For those with financial security, a busy schedule, and a dense social network, living alone can be productive because it offers access to privacy, restoration, and personal development. But for the vulnerable, it more often leads to what Berkeley sociologist Sandra Smith calls defensive individualism, a dangerous state that fosters distrust toward other people and institutions, and ultimately toward the self as well. Most people who live alone are financially secure, not poor, and those who purposely use their domestic space as an oasis from their busy, stressful work lives report that it is a regenerative, not an isolating experience. Phil is a successful journalist in his late 40s, and he says that working and living in Manhattan requires giving so much of himself that at the end of the day he needs to shut things out. "I wouldn't say I'm a solitary person," he explains, "but I like privacy. I need time to recharge." Unmistakably outgoing, with a warm smile and a kind demeanor, Phil has spent most of the past 2 decades living independently, and he's learned how to organize his home so that it accommodates the particular kind of solitude he seeks. "I like having control of my own space, making it like my childhood room at large, but calm, like how it feels in church. I not only live alone, I've mostly lived without a television, without a pet." Phil sees domestic tranquility as a means of deepening his self-knowledge and, in turn, enhancing his creativity. He believes that the time he spends alone helps him to be a better writer, a better thinker, and a more engaging person. Like the late psychologist Anthony Storr, Phil argues that solitude can bring us closer to ourselves, and he can rattle off a long list of great artists and authors who spent most of their lives in a place of their own. Although his life has never been busier, living alone gives Phil ample time to confront his feelings, and he says that now, instead of getting bogged down by questions about how he got here, he uses his hours at home to think about where he's heading and whether he's living the way he wants. As he approaches 50, he realizes that if he stays single, there will be new challenges ahead. The frailty of aging and the growing awareness of one's own fatality start to factor in. You think, you know, what's going to happen? What's scary, Phil says, is the prospect of dying without loved ones nearby. The big thing that changes with age in terms of living alone is that the words dying and alone start to become associated with each other, he explains. Nobody worries about dying married. Amy, who works for a food magazine, is too busy to worry about what will happen to her as she ages. She's a youthful 38 with long brown hair and sharply defined features. Like Phil, she says that her job requires a lot of social interaction. I'm dealing with creative people. There are divas and egos that you have to manage. I have to cuddle, cajole, threaten, be passive-aggressive. Added to her formal work responsibilities, this relationship management takes a toll on her, especially during the busy periods. 2 weeks out of every month, we're working 12, 14, 16-hour days. I can't plan anything. Usually, she doesn't want to. Work is very social, she reports, and I like the peace of coming home and not having to interact anymore, having a chance to decompress. At the beginning of our interview, she tells me that she moved into a place of her own once she could afford it, but once she gets more comfortable, she reveals another layer of her story. She has moved from a shared apartment into a place of her own twice during the past 10 years, and while having money to pay the rent was necessary, in both cases she made the change to escape domestic relationships that were dragging her down. The first time was in Los Angeles, where she had been living with her brother after graduating from college and cycling through a series of bad roommates. "I just couldn't live with him anymore," Amy explains. "He was driving me nuts, and I had to get away." Getting her own place proved liberating. Not only did it make her feel like a real adult, it also restored her sense of autonomy and self-control. The second time was more painful. She was in New York, where she had moved in with her boyfriend and begun to imagine their life together. "It was far more intimate and intense than living with roommates," Amy reports. But she poured herself into it because she was in love, and she knew they could make things work. Only they couldn't. As she later learned, her boyfriend was secretly dating a woman in her early 20s. "He was a jerk," Amy says with well-earned hostility. "I found out that he had been cheating on me since the first month we moved in together. He had been lying to me the whole time, and I didn't know." Scarred from the experience, Amy ruled out any kind of shared housing situation and has vowed that she will live alone, safely removed from a potentially harmful roommate or partner, until she finds someone who earns her trust and affection. She's not shy about looking, but she does so slowly and cautiously, ever mindful of what she has to lose. Amy may be cautious, but as a relatively comfortable and secure young professional, she is far less self-protective than the many disadvantaged city dwellers who choose to live alone to avoid friends and family who have previously contributed to their problems and may still threaten to put them in harm's way. Within a few miles of Amy's spacious apartment, there are thousands of solitary men clustered in New York City's remaining stock of single-room occupancy dwellings and studios. These men are struggling to shake off a heavy load of burdens: substance abuse, a criminal record, poverty, unemployment, and disease are common and often overlapping. The ranks of men in this situation have grown steadily since the 1970s, due not only to the collapse of the industrial labor market and the fact that employers in the service sector are reluctant to hire them, but also to the rise of women in the paid workforce, the vast expansion of the penal system, and the retrenchment of social services for the poor. In 2006, the New York Times reported, "About 18% of men ages 40 to 44 with less than 4 years of college have never married, according to census estimates. That is up from about 6% a quarter century ago. Among similar men ages 35 to 39, the portion jumped to 22% from 8% in that time." The economic crisis of the late 2000s made things even worse, and in 2010, as a Pew Research Center study of the New Economics of Marriage showed, single men without a college degree had even less income and fewer prospects than they did in 1970, making them more unmarriageable than they were then. Many of these men see living alone as a necessary evil, since it gives them the time and space to regain their footing, but it deprives them of much-needed care and social support. Greg, who's unemployed, is in his early 50s and suffers from severe heart disease. During the past 10 years, he's lived alone, mostly in shelters and SROs around Manhattan. When he recounts his life story, it's clear that, for men in his situation, close ties with friends and family members can be helpful or harmful, depending on the circumstance. Communities, in this way, are a lot like marriages. When they're good, they're very good. But when they're bad, they're dangerous. Not long ago, Greg was hospitalized after a heart attack, and he worries about a recurrence. "I think about that sometimes, me being in a house alone. It could be a disadvantage. It might be good if I have somebody around me." But who? Greg used to be a drug addict, and for roughly 20 years he lived between jail cells, abandoned buildings, and the streets. "I went in and out of jail, in and out of jail, in and out of jail, until around 97 or 98. I hadn't had a job in over 20 years because I stayed on drugs a long time." Greg had two children with a common-law wife. He says the state wouldn't let them stay together because they couldn't afford an apartment together, and he's never spent a night with the kids. Their mother died recently, and these days he rarely sees his other family members. Eventually, Greg would like to spend more time with his children, and maybe with other family too. Although he has been off drugs for nearly a decade, he knows that day is a long time off. For now, Greg has devised an alternative strategy for soliciting care and attention after a heart attack. "No matter where I'm at, nobody with me or nothing like that, if it did come down on me, I make sure I get out in the hallway. I'll get to my door real quick. You don't last that long after it hits you because it cuts your wind. You can't breathe, so you're gonna pass out. If I got in the hallway and fell, somebody coming down the next floor probably see me. Might take a little time, though. Might be too late, 'cause wasn't nobody on my floor. But if I got out in the hallway, somewhere down the line, somebody coming in gonna see me." The shelters and SROs where Greg has lived pack a lot of people into small spaces, and there's considerable human traffic in the common areas and hallways. Greg could try to develop some relationships in the building and use them for social support, but he's wary of his co-residents. He's even more cautious around his older friends. "I had a lot of headaches in my days by knowing people, the type of friends that I've had. You know, it's like, oh man, let me have this, let me have that. And you know, when you got a friend, if he got a problem, you got a problem, because they're gonna bring it to you. Back in those years, we just thick and thin. Everything was us together. We do our drugs together, go to homes, abandoned buildings together." Occasionally, Greg gets lonely and longs for good company, but he fears that spending time with the people in his network will lead him down the wrong path. "Most of those guys, I hardly see them anymore. I kind of avoid things like that nowadays. I guess it's kind of on me. I don't be trying to make friends to talk to. Hi and bye, how you doing? Almost every day I go outside, but you know, most of the time I just go to the park, read my book. I'm not real conversational here lately. I've been so much into myself." Tim, who's in his 50s, has also decided that he's better off keeping to himself in a small room rather than trying to live with a partner or roommates. "Whenever I lived with roommates, well, those people were always on drugs and stuff. I like being alone right now because I can't blame anybody except myself if I fuck up. It's like I'm not antisocial, but I have a hard enough time with my own problems without other people's problems." Recently, Tim moved into an SRO with a staff offering social services and decent security because he wanted a place that felt safer and more anonymous than his previous building. There's other hotels like this with people doing drugs and stuff saying, "Hey, you want to get high or anything?" But here, there's no pressure to do anything. You can just go to your room every day, you know, come home and close your door, and nobody's here to bother you. There's nobody knocking at your door. Poor men who live in SROs and low-cost efficiency apartments build interpersonal barriers to defend themselves from the potentially corrupting social influence of their peers. Others, particularly those who have fallen down the class ladder and hope to climb up again, distance themselves from co-residents to evade the stigma of poverty and failure. Some of them avoid family, former partners, and old friends because they're ashamed of their status or because they believe they've been abandoned by those who are fed up with or ashamed of them. Although poor men who live alone often express an abstract interest in finding a partner or reconnecting with another community, in practice, the obstacles to doing either are so daunting that maintaining independence takes precedence. The result is a vicious circle. Self-imposed social isolation removes impoverished singles from job networks and potential sources of support, increases stress, and compromises health, placing them at risk for even greater detachment and suffering. A striking number of the SRO and shelter residents we interviewed reported that they had kept to themselves because they were overwhelmed by the illnesses and deaths among people close to them. For men who, like Greg, come from poor or unhealthy environments, staying close to old friends and family members carries a risk of being exposed to trauma as well as trouble. Rick, who's 50 and gay, was at a loss when asked about his close relationships. "Everybody's dead. Everybody. It was like a swipe. I lost like 8 to 9 people within a period of like 5 or 6 years, along with family members. I was close to my older brother, very close, and he was talking to me about my friend, Rick's recently deceased partner, and helping me in everything. And last October I was getting ready to meet him for lunch, and I was leaving here and the phone rang, and he was getting dressed to meet me and died. So you see, there was just a pattern to everything." Rick's response was to hunker down in his room. He keeps his television on around the clock, using it as a diversion when he's awake and as background noise when he sleeps, turning it off only when he leaves the room. It's not an exciting life, he says, but it protects him from future pain. "Right now I have absolutely no friends, and I guess it's my choice to be just on my own. I used to be a very outgoing person, and now I'm not really a people person. I just come in my place, go in and out. That's it." Miguel has recently been through a similarly brutal stretch, and he's responded by retreating into solitude. He says that his goal is to achieve greater autonomy so he won't need to depend on others who, he fears, will disappoint him or disappear. "I can't really say right now that I have a close friend or that I'm even looking to get a close friend. This particular experience that I'm involved with now is giving me a chance to grow more as a man, to allow the man in me to mature more, in the total sense, and to become self-sufficient and of self-worth in my own right. What I need to do is to learn to become my own close friend and best friend, and to love myself, and feel self-worth and validation." While some men in the SROs stay close to their buildings to avoid friends and family, others worry more about the company inside. Nick, who's in his mid-30s, reports that "most of my old friends are either dead or incarcerated." He contracted HIV from a blood transfusion when he was a teenager, spent years fighting a drug addiction, got married, had a child, got a GED, then a divorce, and soon after, his life fell apart. He's been unemployed for 6 years, living off disability insurance and spending most of his nights in SROs that were heavily drug-infested, mouse-ridden, cockroach-ridden places where there were blatant sales, prostitution, and junkies from every drug that you could think of, dopeheads to crackheads to alcoholics. Nick says that when you've lived in a place where everything is rotten, you seem to be rotten. He had friends in the building, and he was reluctant to leave them because he liked to party. But when things got bad, he'd try to avoid them. I became very, very, very reclusive. If I didn't have to go out, I didn't go out. His friends didn't appreciate this treatment, however, and Nick's life got even rougher. You got people knocking on your door at 3 in the morning, you know? It was nuts. I was getting into fights, verbally and physically. Nick became desperate to distance himself from his neighbors and started looking for a safer, cleaner place to live. Eventually, he found one, and when he moved, he brought along an important lesson. Keep to yourself. His new SRO has a comfortable common area, and residents gather there daily to pass the time talking, reading the paper, and watching TV. Occasionally, the staff offers a meal, or a movie, or classes for the residents. Nick avoids all of this. I don't partake in the social life of this building. I kind of stick to myself. I really don't like people to know my business. He's cautious about the men in his situation because they remind him of the man he used to be, as well as the people he's been trying to avoid. Everybody wants to know something, and once they do, they think they've got your number, he says. They start issuing invitations, they harass you, they pull you down. Like Rick and several other SRO residents, Nick spends a great deal of time locked in his room with the television on. The less I have to interact, the better it is for me, Nick says. I don't even know one person's name in this whole building. Nick hopes that the new, nicer SRO will help him with the transition out of poverty, joblessness, and addiction. He wants his stay to be temporary, though he admits that if he comes to like it there, it might beat his other options. His ex-wife is remarried, and he doesn't see her anymore. But he has family in Brooklyn, and he'd like to spend more time with his children. Nick also misses the warmth of a companion sleeping beside him, and he could imagine living with a partner after he cleans up. For right now, he says, I'm not going nowhere. Hopefully once I can start to get back on my feet a little better, you know, as my health continues, hopefully I'll go back to work. And possibly one day, you know, move out of here or, you know, stay here. For now, I'm here. I'm in a good place. So I'm not going to screw that up. For some men in the building, however, it's hard to appreciate being in a good place when other residents are in such noticeably bad shape. Downwardly mobile residents, men who once had stable jobs and a decent income, are often embarrassed to have landed in the stigmatized world of SROs, and they distance themselves from their neighbors as a way of maintaining self-esteem. John, for instance, wound up in his SRO because he couldn't find any other housing that he could afford with his disability check. He's been in his current place for 4 years, during which he's made only one friend. The majority of people I try to keep away from, he says. The substance abusers and mentally ill residents who congregate in public spaces give you a clue there's something wrong here, know what I mean? I'm not going to socialize with these people. Bob, who's in his early 60s and has lived on his own for most of his life, ran a small business out of the house he owned until the state came and condemned my whole block through the wonders of the eminent domain laws. He had a hard time adjusting to the new building. When I was first brought in here, I mean, I was practically in tears. I wouldn't even sleep in here. I slept in a basement on 55th Street for the first week. I didn't want nothing to do with this. Bob eventually grew more comfortable in his building. He has gotten to know and respect the social workers, whom he sees as remarkably caring. He's pleased about the security, and he appreciates how well the staff maintains the common spaces. But no matter how much the environment satisfies him, it's still an SRO. not the apartment with a garden in which he once took so much pride. No matter how professional the staff is, the other tenants bear the marks of poverty, illness, and hardship, and for outsiders, they can be an unsightly bunch. Knowing this, residents like Bob acknowledge that they feel some shame about their situation, and many try to save face by turning away from family and friends who might otherwise be close to them. They go solo because they don't want anyone to see how far they have fallen, or because they fear that others want nothing to do with them. Nick, for instance, explains that he pulled away from his children and their mother after he started living in SROs. "I wasn't around much for them. I didn't like where I was living. I didn't like the way I was living. So a lot of times I wouldn't show my face. The environment I was living in was taking a toll on me. And it's more embarrassment, I guess you'd say, than anything. I just didn't want people to know and see how I was." Tim, who says that living alone can be horrible and lonely, has lost touch with his ex-wife and children, whom he tried to protect from his downtrodden environment. Now he's reluctant to reach out to family or search for a new partner because, "at this time in my life, you know, I have nothing to offer anyone." Some men believe that their family members devalued them when they moved into the world of poor single men and complain that they've been abandoned. "I'm treated different since I'm alone," Rick says. "It seems like now nobody cares." Mary Ann would have understood that feeling. She lived alone for decades, and in the fall of 2007, she died that way too. She was 79 years old when she called herself an ambulance and went into a hospital near her home in Los Angeles. Her life ended there 2 weeks later, after a full cardiac arrest. When it happened, Mary Ann didn't have a friend or relative at her side. In fact, the only person she'd even listed as an emergency contact was Sue, who delivered drugs for her pharmacy. "I was really surprised when they called me and said my name was on there as the person to contact," Sue tells me when I visit her home in a working-class neighborhood in Huffington Park. "I went, 'Oh, really? Okay.'" She laughs nervously, looks toward the Christmas decorations that saturate her living room, and continues, "I didn't even know if she had a brother or family." Sue had last heard from Mary Ann on a phone call from the hospital. She'd left an urgent message pleading with Sue to feed and look after her two dogs, who were chained up outside the house. "When she called, she was just crying. She said that if somebody doesn't pick up the mail, they'll take her dogs away. They're all I have," she said. She goes, "I promise I won't cheat you. I'll pay you." I wasn't worried about that. It just broke my heart a little that she'd think, "They're all I have." I visited the hospital 2 weeks after Mary Ann's death because her body and belongings were still there. No one had planned a funeral or even picked up her things. I wasn't there alone. Emily Issa, a deputy investigator for the Los Angeles County Public Administrator, was letting me shadow her. Emily is one of 100 full-time employees at the County Public Administrator's office, which investigates cases in which someone dies and no one claims the body or the estate. She is sort of like a detective for people who die alone. Her job is to comb through the remains of their lives, searching for next of kin, trying to figure out what they've left behind and who should get it. Emily and her colleagues get about 3,000 cases like this one each year. Mary Ann was single, with no known siblings or children. But she owned her house, she had a bank account, and who knows what other valuables she left behind in her home. Now someone stands to inherit it, and Emily's job is to find out who. She's looking for someone who knew Mary Ann to lead her to a relative. There's also the question of who's going to bury her. Before Emily's finished, she'll have to resolve that, too. We start our search in the hospital's patient services office. There's a nun working there, and at first we think she might know something helpful, because when she sees Mary Ann's name on the case file, her face lights up. but it turns out she spoke to her only a few times, and she has little to offer besides the assurance that Marianne got good care until the end. The nun hands Emily a big plastic bag. Inside is everything Marianne brought with her to the hospital, and Emily starts digging through it, looking for clues. There's a fluffy blue robe, a small black purse, prescription drugs, baby powder, glasses, coupons, typical things you would find in a woman's purse. None of this is of much use to Emily. She needs contact information, an address book, a cell phone with some names on the speed dial. There's nothing like that in the purse. She finds a notebook and she flips through it in search of a personal note, maybe a list of last wishes. But every page is blank. What she does get is a set of keys to Marianne's house. The best-case scenario, Emily tells me, is that once we get there, we'll find a will or some instructions. But that happens only rarely. In her line of work, it's like hitting the jackpot. I've been out to a case where I walk in, and on the nightstand next to the bed, it says, "In case of emergency." 5 minutes and I'm done. Marianne's case isn't that easy. When we get to her house, her two dogs are still chained up in the yard, so Emily calls animal control to take them away. The outside of Marianne's house is a mess. The wood panels are rotting. There's powdery gray dirt where grass once lived. An old VW minibus with flat tires sits in the dusty driveway. Marianne used it for storage. It looks like it hasn't been driven for years. The inside of the house is even worse. It's dark and dusty, cluttered with stacks of video cassettes, empty juice cans, boxes from the Home Shopping Network, many never even opened. Emily, who seems completely unfazed by the scene, declares it mildly pack-rat. I tell her it seems really pack-rat to me, so she explains her classification. You can still see the ground. We see plenty of cases where you can't even walk on the ground because it's packed with stuff. You're climbing over everything. Emily is so used to places like this that she never goes on a search without gloves and tennis shoes, and a mask in case the person died at home and wasn't found for a while. Usually she has to dig around. Emily doesn't just open drawers and medicine cabinets. If she has to, she climbs to the attic. She breaks down locked doors. She once found someone's business records in a refrigerator, in the vegetable bin. Emily searches through Marianne's living room. You can tell she had basically condensed her life into this one area. There's an unmade makeshift daybed in front of the dusty television. Emily lifts up layers of the bed, searching for money, letters, anything that might connect her to the world outside. But there's nothing under there, just stacks of egg crates and musty blankets. A few feet beyond the bed, we find an entire dining room set hidden under the clutter. Emily seizes on a stack of mail and canceled checks and starts rifling through it. She still doesn't find what she's looking for. No business card from an attorney or an accountant. No photos of friends or relatives. Not even a personal check. Just payments to ARP, Ladies' Home Journal, TV Guide. In fact, there's not a single sign that there was another person in Marianne's life. And I find that much stranger than the mess. After Emily and I have been there 45 minutes without finding even one personal item, I ask her if this is unusual. "Not at all," she replies. "It's just like this. People surrounding themselves with things, things rather than people. She almost built herself into a little cubby like a cave here behind all her stuff. You can tell this is where she spent most of her time." Emily's just looking for contact information, not to piece together someone's life story. But sometimes she gets those stories anyway. She tells me about two cases that she hasn't been able to stop thinking about. One involves a woman whose husband died in World War II. She survived another 60 years, but her personal correspondence was a record of how she'd tried to keep her mind in the 1940s. The other concerns a man who killed himself by smoking up his room with a portable barbecue grill, which he'd placed on his bed. When she arrived, Emily tells me, the whole apartment was black from the smoke, and the only white spaces were the ones she and the dead man had left with their footprints. It was disturbing, not only because of the nature of the suicide, but also because of the way that the footprints connected her to the case. Emily doesn't have time to dwell on these stories, though. There's too much work to do at Mary Ann's. More than 90 minutes into the search, Emily finally finds something personal. Buried in a pile on one of the dressers is a sign of a family history, a picture book with photographs of a little girl dancing and some others from a studio, the kind used as headshots in Hollywood. The child is pretty, with Shirley Temple curls and deep dimples, but we don't actually know that it's Mary Ann because the label says only 1933. There's not a name in sight. It's remarkable how little we find out about Mary Ann. We learn that her mother once lived with her at this address because there's lots of mail to her. Mary Ann was into herbal medicine and natural remedies. Her father married four times, and her mom was his third wife. She'd microchipped her dogs. Emily tells me she doesn't want to make a personal connection with the people she's investigating. She doesn't usually try to figure them out because there are so many of them that it would be emotionally draining. I ask Emily if she ever wonders who Mary Ann thought would clean up her stuff. "No," she replies. "It's never even crossed my mind. Most of the time you see these people don't want anyone in here. People who knew them never knew this part of their lives existed." She must have known that someday she would die and someone would find all these things, I insist. Emily speculates. Maybe it's because she didn't think she had anyone to leave it to. Who cares about my mess because I have no one to leave it to anyway? After nearly 2 hours, the only thing we've found that might help Emily track down a relative is a 30-year-old Christmas card addressed to Mary Ann and her mother. It's from a family in Virginia, and they must be related, because in the card they ask for help with a family tree for their kids. Emily deposits it in the clear plastic bag she'll bring back to the office. By now it is getting late in the afternoon, and Emily has to return to her office because there's a 5 p.m. deadline for bringing valuable items that belong in the estate to storage. Emily seals the front door, and we walk outside. A few neighbors are looking at us, curiously, and we approach them. She asks Luis, who owns the house next door, if Mary Ann's family ever came by. "She had no visitors," he says, "just different ladies who used to come and help her." There's a beat of uncomfortable silence as we all think about Mary Ann. Luis breaks it. "She didn't seem to be a very happy lady. She was lonely most of the years. She had two dogs with her, and that's it." Moments later, we run into another neighbor, George, who has a different take. "She was a nice person," he says. "All the time she talked to us. She talked with my son. Every day I come to work, sometimes I'd see her on the porch. We'd say, 'Hi, Mary.' 'Hi, George.' That's it." Talking with George and Luis helps me understand something about what happens when truly isolated people die alone. In most cases, we can't actually know whether their solitude was a source of sadness or satisfaction, whether they lived and died without friends or family nearby because they preferred it that way or because something went wrong once and they couldn't get it right. When we hear about someone like Mary Ann, we can't help but project some of our own feelings into her story. And our reactions say as much about each one of us as they do about the deceased. The next morning, I meet Emily at the public administrator's office, where she's busy making phone calls from her cubicle. She's tracked down the number of Terry, whose name was the one clue she found in Mary Ann's house on that 30-year-old Christmas card. But when Emily gets him on the phone, there's a problem. He's got no idea who Mary Ann is. Terry tells Emily to call his ex-wife. She's the one who actually wrote the card. Moments later, Emily's talking to her. Oh, Emily remarks. He's the one who gave me the phone number for you, and he said he'd never heard of her. So you think she was his aunt? I see. The ex-wife was partly right. Marianne was a relative of Terry's, but a distant one. Her mother was Terry's great-aunt. But Terry had never met Marianne, never even spoken to her, and he knew virtually nothing about her. We've been just going back and forth on this trying to find out who she was, Terry explains. He says he felt sad when he heard about Marianne's situation, but he admits it is hard to feel emotional about her death. My only feeling toward this right now is I feel responsibility to try to resolve her situation, to kind of tidy up her life, I guess. 1 month after Marianne's death, Terry and his cousins were still deciding whether they wanted the county to settle the estate or handle it themselves. Emily tells me that because Marianne's assets total more than $6,000, the public administrator could arrange for her to be buried in a local cemetery. If Marianne didn't have $6,000, L.A. County would still take care of things. When people die alone here without the money for burial, their bodies are cremated and their ashes are stored in individual boxes for 4 years. After that, if no one claims them, they're buried together in a mass grave. The burial takes place once a year in the corner of a massive cemetery near the USC Medical School in East L.A. The ceremony for all the unclaimed people from 2003 takes place just a couple weeks after Marianne's death. A chaplain officiates the service. Honored guests, on this day, December 6, 2007, we're gathered here, 1,918 brothers and sisters of humankind. It's a heartfelt occasion, but it's a little empty, too. Besides the chaplain, only about 10 people, all county employees, show up for the mass burial. One of them points out the tiny plaques that mark each year's gravesite. The remains of nearly 2,000 people fill a hole that's only 10 feet long, 8 feet wide, 8 feet deep. And I can't help thinking, right here, all these thousands of people who lived and died alone, they aren't alone anymore. 5. Together Alone.